the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It's Ask Anything Wednesday, which means you set the agenda. We're glad to talk about what's on your mind. Here in the central day of the week, you get to decide what we talk about, and we'll talk about what you're talking about. Perhaps in your neighborhood, on your college or university campus, what's going on in terms of the conversation around your dinner table, or perhaps in your place of work. We're glad to talk about anything you want to talk about on Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number, as always, is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And we're about the business of intelligent Christian conversation. That means you set the agenda today, and we're going to try to do our very best to figure out how intelligent Christians would think intelligently about the topic that you're raising. It can be an issue of theology, Bible, doctrine, an issue of church life, family life, marriage, children, parenting. It can be about popular culture, politics, entertainment, Hollywood, you name it. We'll talk about it. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There are some big issues in the news, as always. Today is Earth Day. No kidding. We are now in the day that is celebrated as Earth Day. And by the way, when you start thinking about what this means, it comes out of the ecological movement that began back in the 60s in particular, that gave birth to a particular day to give attention to the need for any kind of environmental concern. The very first Earth Days were about such things as environmental and industrial pollutants, cleaning up such things as the Great Lakes, in particular Lake Erie, planting more trees. The big problem when Earth Day was first a reality was a four-letter word you don't hear about much anymore, at least in most parts of the United States. That word is smog. Smog, which is the combination of smoke and fog, was a notorious problem in many of the nation's cities and metropolitan areas. One of the great advances environmentally, ecologically, of America over the last several decades is that we have moved from a nation that was relatively unconcerned about such things as environmental pollution. We were dumping literally tons and tons, millions of gallons of toxins into our rivers, into our great water sources, including the Great Lakes. Lake Erie was once infamously burning, as the surface of the lake was so filled with toxins and with the buildup of dead algae that it literally caught fire and burned for some period of time. You look back in, for instance, the anti-littering campaign of the 1960s and the 1970s, showing a Native American looking at a highway with litter with a tear coming down his cheek. That was all a part of the early environmental consciousness. Now fast forward to where we are now. Now we are looking at President Obama today unveiling any number of rather ambitious goals to combat climate change all over the world. Pollution was the big issue back then. Environmental degradation was the big issue back when Earth Day began. Now it's about a far larger global context of climate change. Several interesting things will come out of this. One of the things that is now being revealed is that in Washington, the debate over climate change, over such proposals as cap and trade, I find, by the way, most of these proposals very problematic. That it is now a matter of intense lobbying activity. And the Chicago Tribune has one of the best stories out on this, demonstrating just how much activity is going on with this. Jim Tankersley, the Washington Bureau of the Chicago Tribune, is referring to the fact that in the House, Democrats began 3 days of hearings on the massive energy and climate change bill that is being promoted by the Obama administration, now before Congress, inviting testimony from three cabinet secretaries, more than a dozen captains of industry, labor, and the environmental movement. That's going to be huge. But look at this. Listen to what Jim Tankersley has to say here. He says, and the political theatrics were only the most visible part of what shapes up to be a frenzied lobbying fight over an issue that pits some of the nation's highest powered interests against one another in a tangle of coalitions and alliances of convenience. Joe Stanislaw, one of these lobbyists who has been following climate legislation closely, said, quote, it's the biggest game in town, end quote. Now, folks, the reason I bring this up is because one of the difficulties, especially on the issue of climate change, especially on the issue of environmentalism, is figuring out, even if you think you know where you stand on these issues, is figuring out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Because when it comes to the way legislation is made, you have this coalition of changing constellations of partnerships. You've got lobbyists on both sides. You've got people under contract. You have an enormous profit motive, an enormous financial incentive for people on all sides of whatever legislation comes out here. There are people who have their own pet kinds of technologies, their own personal investments in these technologies that will supposedly lower carbon emissions and the supposedly green technologies. Well, when you actually come to writing legislation, Congress is going to decide to favor some of these technologies over others. Big money involved there. You've got also all kinds of huge economic issues here. Let's say that you decide that you want to cut down on the number of miles Americans drive a year because you want to cut down on the number of gallons of gas they consume and the amount of carbon that is released from their automobiles into the atmosphere. Now, that sounds like a simple thing. Come up with some way of incentivizing driving fewer miles or, which is more likely the government alternative, come up with a way of de-incentivizing, creating disincentives for persons to drive. Well, you say, all right, let's come up with something else. Let's raise the tax on gasoline. Well, there's a ricochet effect to the entire economy because it's not only the folks in the suburbs who drive cars who pay the gas and will pay the gas tax. It's also the school system with the school buses. It's also, well, you say, let's shift people from private transportation and automobiles. Let's put them on public transportation. Well, the public transportation system's not ready for that kind of massive influx. And by the way, they use energy too. You know, you're looking at all kinds of things here. The issue of ethanol has been a big issue in this country. You know, you look at the way we elect presidents and the way we choose party nominees, you know where that first caucus is? It's in Iowa. You know what one of the big issues there is? Of course, it is the manufacture and sale of ethanol as a fuel additive and fuel substitute, and it comes from the growing of corn, which is big business in Iowa. If you're running for either the Republican or the Democratic nomination for president, you're going to have you're going to have the issue of ethanol very clearly on your horizon. Now, that leads to a rather warped play out in the Democratic process of that one issue because an awful lot of people in Washington are figuring, I might run for president one day. And I've got to be very, very careful where I stand on the ethanol issue because of the Iowa caucuses. Do you see how complex this is? You know what it reminds us of? It reminds us that politics is taking place in a world that is corrupted by sin. That doesn't mean we just get out of it and give up. That's the last thing we need. But it means that there can be no utopian pretensions about how government can solve a problem. Government can make a difference. And on the environmental issue where we are all concerned with wanting to be good stewards as Christians of the earth the world has given us, let's be thankful that Lake Erie is no longer burning. Let's be thankful that government did have a role in limiting the kind of pollutants that were acceptable and giving some oversight as to what could and could not be done in terms of the environment. But let's also realize that in the end, it was, by and large, a market system that produced its own disincentives to pollution because the American people made clear they want to buy products from companies who have a good environmental record, that they want to buy products that are safe and clean and non-toxic to their children. When you start looking at where we are with all these proposals today, I don't want to be an extremist on one side to say government has no role here because that simply makes no sense given the intrusion of government, the size of government, the reach of government within our society. But I am very perplexed by those who really think the government can solve this problem, whether it's the United Nations or the United States of America or your state government or municipality. Government won't solve the problem. Not on Earth Day, not on any day. It has a role, and one of the issues for Christians is figuring out what that appropriate role would be. And especially when, for instance, I really appreciated Jim Tankersley's story, you know, when he writes in the Chicago Tribune about how now in the midst of the government saying what we're trying to do is to do good, the government saying what we're really trying to do is to serve the environment, what we're really trying to do is to mitigate climate change and do what is green and right. Well, you just watch the deals that are cut. There will be winners and losers, and when you've got this many lobbyists crawling all over the place, and by the way, that's the price of being in a democracy. You see, if we weren't a democracy, we wouldn't have to put up with lobbyists. It would be worse. But in the messiness of government in a fallen world, when the deals are struck, there are winners and there are losers, and they are not always what is in best keeping with the goal of the legislation in the first place. Let me tell you something to watch in coming months. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom has formally announced his candidacy to be California governor. Now, this is going to be really interesting. Gavin Newsom was and is the mayor of San Francisco. He's the one who unilaterally declared he was going to be issuing same-sex marriage licenses in San Francisco. It lasted for some time until it was shut down. This is a man who puts himself on the far left of the Democratic Party, and guess who he's going to run against? This is a 41-year-old mayor of San Francisco for the Democratic nomination for the office of governor of California. He's going to run against Attorney General Jerry Brown, exactly 30 years older than himself, who was himself governor from 1975 to 1983, where he earned the name and title Governor Moonbeam. It'll be fascinating to watch California. Frankly, it usually is when it comes to politics. We'll be back to talk about what's on your mind when it comes to the conversation at your dinner table, on your college campus, your local church, wherever. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and you set the agenda when we come right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It's Ask Anything Wednesday, and you set the agenda. The number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go directly to Chad in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Chad.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. Do you think it's appropriate for women to be in combat in the Iraq war?
Chad, I appreciate the question, and the answer to that is real quick. I don't believe it is appropriate for women to be in combat, period. I think it demeans women. I think it is a failure to understand the key distinction in the difference between men and women and men honoring women. I think men have a responsibility to protect women, and the last thing we should do is to put women in combat, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else. Now, there are situations in which, of course, things happen where all of a sudden a woman may be in a situation where she has to defend herself or to defend her children, defend her family, and there's nothing dishonorable about that, but we should never intentionally put a woman in that position and put a woman in combat or, for that matter, a woman in a position of vulnerability. You know, Chad, I just I have to answer that question by thinking about the picture that necessarily comes to mind. What happens when, for instance, you've got two soldiers side by side, a man and a woman, and they're both in uniform, they have the same gun, they have the same weapon, they're in the same position, and enemy fire comes? I got to tell you, if I'm that man, I'm going to be worried about protecting that woman standing beside me. I'm going to think that that's a God-given instinct, Chad, that I'm supposed to honor. I appreciate your call. Let me tell you, at my website at albertmohler.com, you'll find both commentaries and blog articles in which I really try to set out the case as to why women should not be in the military. And that's going to be a coming issue. It sounds to me like it might be an issue where you live and where you are. It's going to be an issue before this administration very shortly. Chad, can I tell you, where did this question come up?
I just thought, I don't know, I just didn't think that it was right for women to just fight. I thought that it was a men's job.
Well, let me tell you, it's a lamentable job for anyone, but in a fallen world, in a sinful world, the fact is that often, in the name of protecting the vulnerable and protecting a nation, protecting what is right, one has to use force. And that is a legitimate and lamentable necessity in this world, Chad. But I think you're exactly right. I want to tell you, I think your instinct on this is not something that just comes by, the pressure or the influence of a society around you. I think it comes from inside your heart, and I think God put it there. And, Chad, I'm glad it's there. And I'm glad you called today. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Hardinsburg, Indiana, where Bill's listening also on WFIA. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. I have some family members that's involved in pagan worship. How do I approach this, and where do I get information?
Now, Bill, I'm going to have just a little bit more information. When you talk about pagan worship, what exactly, if you can go into some just a little bit of detail, are you talking about here?
Well, the only thing they tell us is that they're into pagan worship, and once a year they go to some big meeting and dress up in animal costumes and so forth.
Okay.
But that's all they'll tell us.
Yeah, Bill, let me tell you, this is going to put you in a very, very strange position that some other folks have been in before. This is going to put you in the position of ancient Israel talking to Canaanites. And that may sound extreme, but that's exactly what's going on here. What we have is a repaganization of some persons. Let me tell you, Bill, a lot of this, and you'll know if this fits your family or not, but a lot of this is coming from one wing of the New Age movement, which is basically a collection of all kinds of mystical and spiritualistic kinds of traditions. People are putting them together. It's like baby boomers going into a spiritualist cafeteria and deciding how they want to put together something that looks cool. And some of these pagan practices are coming back. And you know what? These pagan practices are no more dignified, are no less atrocious than they were in the beginning. You know, one of the clearest issues in terms of biblical religion, biblical Christianity, is that, for instance, we do not worship the earth. We do not worship the spirits of the earth. We do not animate things practice a religion of animism. Instead, we are to follow the one true and living God and understand that he has made the world. The world is not his body. He has not given us all these spirits that we are to discern and to worship, but instead, he demands all the worship for himself, and he denies us the right to worship any lesser thing. So when you say, Bill, how do you relate to them? Well, I would suggest to you that you relate to them as absolutely lost people who are probably mixing a little of their say self-therapy and what they think they need in their lives in terms of spirituality with some very confused thought concerning all these paganisms. You know, the most important thing you can give them is the gospel, Bill, a very clear gospel witness. And my guess is, this is just a hunch, but my guess is you're going to find that, like walking through a cafeteria, they're going to try on one pagan practice and then another. I hope that they find themselves ultimately face-to-face with reality, just as the idol worshiper says in Isaiah chapter 44, I have a lie in my hands. This is nothing but dust. I feed on ashes. And, Bill, God bless you for telling them the truth. What resources would I recommend? Well, I tell you, there's some good stuff out there in terms of some websites and some book resources just on a lot of these New Age and pagan practices. And rather than try to detail them here on the air, I'm going to have my staff list some and put them directly on the website for today, and we'll provide some links I hope will be helpful to you, Bill, and you've been helpful with your call. Let's go to Bedford, Texas, where Candace is listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Candace.
Yes, when the Apostle Paul mentioned that women are not supposed to have authority over men or teach, does that include counseling in a Christian setting or teaching mixed children in a Christian school? I would like to know, because my friend feels a calling to minister to teens, but we want to be obedient to the Lord.
Oh, bless your heart, Candace. What a great question, and how nicely asked. Let me just say that, first of all, what you have in the New Testament is God's plan and design for his church, for Christ's church. And the clear issue there is that in the church, there is a pattern of male leadership, a pattern of male teaching responsibility, and of teaching authority that is to be respected and honored as God's plan. The New Testament is not the pattern for instance, a secular organization or for the government, the secular government. And so I had women teachers in high school, and I do not believe that they were violating any divine purpose or divine commandment in being high school teachers. I had women college professors for whom I learned a great deal, and I'm thankful for them. But I'll tell you, Candace, if it means teaching the Bible, that in a Christian school, I would say that that's one of those issues where we would say, well, in this case, we're kind of acting like a church, or we're fulfilling a scriptural that is a churchly function. So if I were organizing the Christian school, I would have men teach the Bible classes. But I would have women teaching all over the school insofar as they were equipped to do so and qualified to do so. I would obviously have the concern about pulling mothers out of homes where and not being with their children. But when it comes to that gender role distinction that is so clear in terms of the New Testament church, I would say it's not the same thing for counseling or teaching in a school setting, and unless that school is really trying to mirror the local church. But there is a distinction there. It's a distinction that I think is important. Candace, I want to tell you something. I am so encouraged to hear from a young woman, a Christian young woman, who really wants to plan her life in accordance with God's glory and God's word. You ask a good question. I'm glad to help you think it through, and I'm glad to hear from others who will be thinking it through with us. Your question could be next on Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. You can also follow us at Twitter. Go to follow Albert Moeller. One word. I just posted a few minutes ago a photograph of the call board just to give you an idea of what it looks like to be on this end of the equation. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Moeller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. We have some great questions. We're being flooded with great questions by Twitter and Facebook and email. We're going to get to as many of those as possible. And I'm just going to let you know today, we're going to have a very special program next week, not on Wednesday, but on Thursday, which is just going to be a series of questions sent in by Twitter and Facebook and email, and not by phone. It's going to be a fun program then, and we're saving some of these questions for that program next week, but we'll get to as many as we can. We're going to get preference to phone calls today at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK from Wilmington, North Carolina. Greg is listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Greg.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Mohler. I teach a church history class at our church, and we've discussed lately about the expansion of the church from Europe to America. And I was wondering if you could tell a little bit about that, the growth of the church and the move to America. Did it come this way because of our American-centric view of the church as compared to the growth of the church to Africa, Asia, other parts of the world?
That's a good question, Greg, and we have to go back to the 17th century to really kind of get our grounding there. In the 17th century, the 1600s, groups of believers started coming from the Old World to the New World because they were looking for a place where they could worship with freedom. And in particular, the Pilgrims, as we know them, the Puritan Congregationalists, who were 17th century pilgrims coming from the Old Country on the Mayflower and coming over in Plymouth Rock, you know that whole story, that they came to establish a beachhead for their own Puritan faith, their separatist Congregationalist faith, here in the New Country, in the New World. And what happened is, for various reasons, a lot of them having to do with the motivation for religious liberty and for Christian missions, you had successive migrations coming across the Atlantic from the Old World to the New. First of all, from Britain, and then especially as you get to the American heartland and to the American colonies. When you get to the young nation and you get to the late 19th century, the early 20th century, you have waves of immigration, of course, from Central and Eastern Europe as well. Those are largely Catholic waves of immigration. But the fact is that Christianity began to grow because America began to grow. And it's kind of a chicken and egg question. Which came first? Well, what happened is that as America became a transcontinental nation from especially the late 18th century until now, well, the population grew exponentially. You're talking about a massive growth in population, and the vast majority of Americans have considered themselves Christians, have been members of some Christian church, have had some Christian identification. And thus, the center of church growth for a great deal of the recent history of the world has been in North America. But that has gone with population growth as well. You know, the reality is, Greg, that right now America is not the fastest growing Christian area of the world. This is not where the fastest growth in terms of the gospel is found. Right now, it is found in two places a long way from here, Africa and China. Africa is the place right now where the gospel is growing. Well, some of the missiologists looking at it describe it as almost viral growth. It's growing so fast. Africa is the one place right now where Christianity is pushing back in terms of growth against the adherents of Islam. That is, the relative number of Christians versus the relative number of Muslims is tilting in a Christian direction in Africa. Very interesting development. But just in terms of sheer population growth, the forecasters tell us that very soon in the 21st century, the nation of China will be both the largest Christian nation on earth and the largest Muslim nation on earth, simply because of the massive size of its population. By the way, it's fascinating that those things would be true a half century after the atheistic revolution of the communist Chinese. So, Greg, I hope that answers your question. It's not an Amero, you know, what can we say here, a North American-centric view of the universe to point to the massive growth of the church here, because something else happened. And, Greg, that is just tragedy, and that is the secularization of Europe, especially in the 20th century. So as the church has been growing here, it has been in decline there. But let's just remember, wherever it's found, it's Christ's church, and Christ will always maintain the witness to his gospel in his people. He will preserve a remnant. And wherever the church is found, the church that holds fast to the gospel and is preaching the word of God, it is more powerful than its numbers suggest. So I appreciate your question, Greg. And, folks, your question can be next. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Fascinating stuff coming here. I love these questions coming in by Twitter and Facebook and email. We're going to get to as many as possible, and we're going to get to a lot of them in a special edition of this program next week. To Ask Anything Wednesday, the phone number 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Let's go to Oviedo, Florida, where Dan's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, how are you doing? I'm calling basically just to ask if this Judge Perez Hilton, who had asked this question of Miss California in the Miss USA competition, if he had been a conservative and had asked maybe the opposite, or maybe asked the question in an opposite way, and she gave an opposite answer, basically, you know, coming out in support of gay marriage, if he had turned around and reacted this in a similar way, calling names and all of that because of her beliefs for gay marriage, I mean, wouldn't he be under some legal? Wouldn't there be legal ramifications? Wouldn't, I mean, it seems like there's a big time double standard in our culture today.
Dan, there may be a double standard. I don't think it's legally actionable, but what you're observing is one of the most interesting things. I am told there are now 1,400 news stories about Carrie Prejean, Miss California, who did not become Miss America, at least in part because of the controversy over her statement. Perez Hilton, from what I can tell, a totally reprehensible figure, has said that was the reason she did not, as one of the judges, and he's in a position to know he was one of the judges. But, you know, I think this is an illustration of, and by the way, I've not dealt with this on this program. I didn't choose to talk about it in the top segment, but now that it's on the docket, I think we ought to look at it and learn from it for just a moment. Let's listen to what actually happened in this Miss America pageant.
Vermont recently became the fourth state to legalize same-sex marriage. Do you think every state should follow suit? Why or why not?
Well, I think it's great that Americans are able to choose one or the other. We live in a land that you can choose same-sex marriage or opposite marriage. And you know what? In my country and in my family, I think that I believe that a marriage should be between a man and a woman. No offense to anybody out there, but that's how I was raised, and that's how I think that it should be between a man and a woman. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think the first thing I can say about this is, once again, we are treated to a beauty queen or beauty contestant who appears to be unable to give much of a clear answer to a question. I mean, first of all, when she starts to answer the question, should other states follow the example of Vermont, she says she's glad to live in a country where people have a choice. Well, let's just say that, first of all, there is no duality of marriage coast to coast in this country. You've got a very small handful of states where same-sex marriage has been legalized. There is no, you have a choice. And then she's very confused when she says people can choose between a homosexual marriage or an opposite marriage. I assume she means opposite sex or heterosexual marriage, but it's kind of confused there. But then she comes back and she says, in my country or in my family, what she's trying to say is, subjectively, her own opinion is that marriage is the union of a man and a woman. So when she finally got to that, well, I believe she's right, but I don't believe it's just her opinion. I don't believe it's just about where she was raised. To give Perry Prejean credit in terms of the pressure of that moment, where she has been interviewed in the media subsequently to that, I think she's been clearer about her conviction on the reality of marriage. But to get back to Dan's question, is there a double standard going on here? Oh, you bet. And one of the things we need to see in this controversy is, number one, that Carrie Prejean did not give a very clear answer against same-sex marriage. She didn't say that she believed that that same-sex marriage should even be illegal or that same-sex union should be not recognized. To the contrary, to the beginning, she said she's glad to live in a country where people have a choice, and she really muddied the water there. She said for herself, She believes that marriage is between a man and a woman. She said, no offense to anyone else. Well, the for myself is the problem. Marriage is a public institution. It is not merely a private contract. And so I think she's very, very confused. I'm glad she believes that marriage is a union of a man and a woman. I am glad of that, and I appreciate that. And I have sympathy for her carrying the weight right now of controversy about that. And I pray for her, and I hope that indeed she will not only stand in a right position here, but I hope that she will also learn a great deal more about what's going on in this to give an even better answer when she's asked it in the future. And I guarantee you she will be asked it in the future, having been so publicly associated with the question in the past. But it's another reminder to us that this very complicated question really comes down to whether or not we believe that marriage is one thing or that it can be many things. If we believe that it can be many things, anything other than the union of a man or a woman, then we open ourselves to just this kind of muddied water as to what exactly we do believe, just this kind of lack of clarity. We're actually giving the world confusion. I'm writing an article right now on what we owe the world, and I'll tell you what Christians owe the world is the gospel of Christ, and we also owe the world a clear answer. And what we really need to work on as Christians is the ability to answer clearly. And if we're going to create controversy with our answer, let's present an intelligent, clear answer that people can understand. And if they're going to reject it, let them reject it. But at least give them a clear answer for them to reject. Dan asked a very interesting question about the double standard. Boy, you really see it here. If you want to see an ominous sign about the future of this culture, just look at how popular culture turned on this young woman and made of her a scapegoat, as if what she said was a scandal. A very interesting observer, by the way, pointed out that what Carrie Prejean said is exactly what President Barack Obama said when he was a candidate for president. In the sense that he said he believes that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, but he believes that homosexual couples should have the same rights. So they didn't say it exactly the same way, but it has basically the same effect. But no one has really condemned the president for making those kinds of statements. But now this young woman is in a very different position. There are all kinds of double standards here, all kinds of lack of confusion here, all kinds of willful distortions here. Media Matters and other websites have been looking at this and pointing out that there's just a lot of confusion on this. When you start looking at what's going on in this particular story, it's just a little picture of how quickly you get into controversy when you start talking about this. But, you know, it's a picture of something else too, isn't it? When you think of all the questions that a contestant might be asked in the Miss America contest, I have very little respect for the whole process, to tell you the truth, but just positing for a moment the fact that some question is going to be asked, what does it tell you that one of the questions asked of a contestant who would be a Miss America is, where do you stand on gay marriage? You see, there are a lot of people who think you can duck the question, but you're not going to be able to duck this question for long. And you know, behind that question is a far more urgent question, and this is the one even many evangelical Christians seem to be trying to duck. Do you believe that homosexuality is a sin? That's a prior question to the gay marriage question, and that too is a question that simply isn't going to disappear. It's Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. We'll be right back with final thoughts in just a moment. Great question sent electronically. Always glad to get these. One sent in and said, do the sheer number of Bible translations which are available today adversely impact the authority of the Scripture? Well, you know, it doesn't adversely impact it in terms of the objective authority of the Bible. That's not going to change. But I know what my question asker is really getting at here, and that is, doesn't it confuse people about the authority of the Word of God when you go in and you seem to have this multiple choice consumer collection of all these translations? I feel the pain, I have to tell you, in this. I feel the frustration. When I'm in one of the major bookstores and I'm standing there in the Bible section, I'm not only embarrassed by how many translations there are, I'm embarrassed by how many consumer products there are. The this Bible, the that Bible, the whatever you think of Bible. Bibles with this cover, Bible with that cover. You know, folks, this is just what happens when you mix religious freedom and a free market and a great hunger for the Word of God. I mean, that's what's basically going on here. Now, I will tell you, even though there is some confusion about having so many translations, there is also some gain. And so I'm glad to be asked this question, and I'm honest to feel the pain in it, too, just to say, yes, I am very frustrated by the fact that this leads to a confusion about the Scripture for many people. But there is the other side of the equation. The other side of the equation is this. If you are a serious student of the Bible, you can have before you several good translations in order to do some really serious scriptural study, looking at parallel translations and doing your very best to come to the absolute conclusion about exactly how the text should be translated and how you should read it, teach it, study it, learn it. And so there is a gain on that on the other side. But, you know, the only way to overcome this would be by reducing religious freedom or by taking away a free market or by something else that would be worse than the problem it is intended to solve. So one of the things I would suggest you do in light of all these translations is stick with the best and recommend that people find their way there. And again, I recommend the English Standard Version and the New American Standard Bible, the Holman Christian Standard Bible. And, you know, the old King James is still a venerable translation. It's just not in the vernacular that people speak today. And one of our principles is that we want the Bible to be read by people as they hear it in the language that they speak, the language that they understand. Another question very quickly. Someone wrote it and said, what if someone loses their mind after making a profession of faith? What if by Alzheimer's disease or some accident or something, someone loses the mind and even loses the capacity to articulate their understanding of the gospel? What if they even somehow deny that that they have known Christ? You know, this is something that comes to many, many family members, especially of the elderly. Let me just give you a word of comfort. When we lose our minds, when by disease or injury we lose that capacity, we lose the responsibility as well. Someone who comes to a saving knowledge of Christ, someone who shows the fruit of regeneration and follows Christ, having suffered later an illness or an accident, I don't believe, well, let me put it this way. As the Bible says, nothing can snatch us out of Christ's hands. Hold that as your confidence. I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.